Thomas McGuane once described his writing style as a crackpot cross between traditional male literature and the Sid Caesar show. He writes about loners, outlaws, and outdoorsmen. McGuane wrote the screenplay for Missouri Breaks, Rancho Deluxe, Cold Feet, and 92 in the Shade, which he also directed. His novels include The Sporting Club, The Bushwhacked Piano, and Panama. His new novel, Keep the Change, is partially set in Montana, where McGuane has lived since the late 60s. He lives on a 3,000-acre ranch where he raises cattle and cutting horses. McGuane rides in the rodeo and has been Montana's cutting horse champion four times. Since several of his screenplays are offbeat westerns, I asked Tom McGuane if moving to Montana fulfilled a cowboy fantasy.
I really kind of got a cowboy fantasy by living there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to go there to be a cowboy. I was just a fisherman. And, ranch life. Ranching is the biggest business in Montana. It's a kind of a daily texture of Montana life. I love horses. I've pretty much always loved horses, but I've passionately loved them as an adult. And then I've ranched. So that's all kind of part of the same reality. The kind of cowboy lifestyle is something that still doesn't appeal to me very much, but I do like ranching, and I do spend a lot of my life horseback.
I figure you must like westerns, because you've rode a few yourself.
I do like them pretty well. They have to be kind of off-center. I mean, my favorite westerns are things like Bad Company and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and kind of atypical westerns. The straight-up western seems kind of silly to me, and really kind of always has.
Why?
The moral simplistics of traditional westerns just kind of doesn't wash for me.
Mm-hmm. What about the atmosphere, and the charisma?
Well, the thing, you know, I love American landscapes of all kinds, and western movies are the only American movies in which American landscapes have much place. I think if there had been a great movement of New England filmmaking with a splendid New England coast and countryside in it, I'd have liked that kind of filmmaking, or California filmmaking, or Alaska filmmaking, where you could really see the earth in the films. But they've either been human, you know, they've been absolutely human sort of closet dramas, or westerns kind of traditionally. So it just happened that was western movies, the only place really where the American land is celebrated in American cinema.
One of the westerns that you wrote is Missouri Breaks,
right?
Which starred Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson. Now, when you heard that they were going to be cast, did you think that was good news?
No, I didn't. I wrote it really hoping to direct the film myself, and I was going to do it with my friends Harry Dean Stanton and Warren Oates, and we were going to make it inexpensively. And then Nicholson and Brando were cast. I mean, it was good news in some degree because you've written something. It looks like it's going to be done in a very auspicious way, and naturally that's rather flattering to any writer. At the same time, it became a different kind of project. I'd seen it as a kind of a piece in which all the characters had sort of equal weight, and it was going to be the loss of a class of frontier people was going to really be what the story was about. With the casting and with the cost of acquiring those two actors for 6 weeks, the story suddenly had to be about Jack and Marlon. And the scenes had to kind of reflect that. So there was an immediate demand for more Brando Nicholson scenes. And that kind of was, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it was rather cross purposes with what I had set out to do. Not that I'm unhappy with what happened to it. There are lots of things that really pleased me tremendously about that movie. But the production values had to go up with the cost of the actors. Everything goes up and kind of as a function of scale. So it had a physical tone in some places that reminded me more of Paint Your Wagon than the kind of mean looking thing that I had imagined.
So did you have to go back and do a lot of rewriting?
Not very much, but the fact that I didn't want to, and in fact finally refused to, meant that they had to find other ways of getting this revision work done. They ended up having Robert Towne come in and rewrite part of the ending, which made me unhappy. But at the same time, I think looking for pride of authorship in screenwriting is a really feckless waste of time.
Brando and Nicholson are two actors who have very distinctive ways of speaking, no matter what character they're playing. Their voices are very Brando and Nicholson.
Right.
When you knew that you were writing scenes for them, did you write any differently hearing their voice in your mind?
No, because it was all written by the time they were there.
How did you feel your dialogue worked in their mouths?
Well, in some cases it did. Brando took such a kind of a perverse approach to things, and also in a kind of an inventive approach to things, that it sometimes was quite rewarding. But I do know that when I found out he was doing it in an Irish accent, I remember being just absolutely astonished, because it was completely inappropriate to the part as written. And it remains an absolute enigma in the movie. Why is Marlon Brando speaking in an Irish accent? There's absolutely no reason for it.
How much did the Missouri Breaks experience sour you on movies?
Well, it soured me fairly considerably, because I think my Rancho Deluxe experience had made me really think that the screenwriter was the author. And after the Missouri Breaks, I would never make that mistake again. I think when movies get fairly expensive, writers get a little bit expendable. They can't really make movies without scripts. In fact, they can hardly finance movies without scripts. It's probably the most essential thing there is in movie making, but writers have allowed the situation to develop so that the writers have little power over the overall production of a movie, especially as compared to directors and actors.
I want to ask you about another screenplay that you wrote in the 70s but was just produced recently into a film, and I'm thinking of Cold Feet, and it starred Keith Carradine, Tom Waits, and Sally Kirkland. There's one line in there I really have to ask you about. Keith Carradine plays a pretty surly jewel thief, and Sally Kirkland plays someone who is in love with him, though he's kind of cool to her. But she comes on to him one morning. He's wanted he's wanted by the police, and he knows that they're after him. She climbs into his bed, and he looks at her, and he says, "Oh, you're not going to make me have sex, are you?" I thought that was a really funny line, in part because people are making love in such unlikely places at such inopportune times in all movies, you know?
Right.
Like they're wanted by the police, or war's breaking out, or, you know, some apocalypse is right around the corner, and the two main characters stop and have sex.
Right. You know? I know. It's a window of opportunity.
Is that line yours? I know the screenplay was co-written. That's why.
Yes, that was.
And what were you thinking about when you wrote it?
Norman Mailer once wrote in The Prisoner of Sex that men have an incredible fragility when it comes to sex that has been insufficiently accounted for in literature. And it occurred to me that there was something just that had a sort of comic value to me about some gangster who was utterly threatened by the prospects of having to have sex. Also, the aggression of Sally Kirkland's character struck me as just absolutely hilarious. It was a kind of a role reversal that wasn't done in a kind of schematic way. And I sort of imagined that the Carradine character was sort of in the position women frequently are in, you know, having somebody just sort of make this elephantine assault without much reference to their desires at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
All those things. I mean, sex is a great thing for producing comedy anyway. It's such an outlandish thing for anyone to be doing. I say facetiously, I hope it's clear. But it defies complete explanation. But I just thought that's one of my favorite funny moments in the film. It's not a film I'm real crazy about, but I thought that was rather funny.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you're famous for in your personal life is a period in the 70s that in which there was a lot of wretched excess, sex, drugs, alcohol, fast cars. Was that still a productive period for you? Were you able to work during that?
Well, the thing that about that, I mean, I certainly did all those things to some degree, not in a degree that would have seemed so remarkable to someone who who was not living quite in the public eye to the degree that I was. I think most people I knew did as many of those things as I did. But they acquire this kind of monumentality because they kind of appear, they get into the press, and then they get enlarged, and then the press begins sort of remarking on the things they themselves created. So to be absolutely candid, it was never quite as big a deal as it's gone down historically as having been. I was very productive in those years.
Mm-hmm.
And like any other year in my adult life, I spent most of it sitting at the typewriter.
A lot of people who do go through a period of excess also have a period of bottoming out, and that's what gets them out of the excessive stuff. Did that happen to you?
Well, a little bit. I mean, John Keats said, how do you know what's enough until you find out what's too much? And my dreams have remained more or less intact. My dreams as an artist, and I've been trying to be a better artist since I was a little kid. And some of the things I tried didn't work, and some of them did. And probably one of them was to sort of hurl myself into that period. I don't have any regrets. In fact, I have some remarkably happy memories from the years that are supposed to have been so completely out of control.
But so how did you find out what's too much?
Well, I think that probably becoming depressed. I mean, I think there's something about the way I was living was sort of depressing me. And when you're depressed, you're sort of dysfunctional in every way. You just can't, I can't work when I'm depressed. And for some reason, something about the way I was living was depressing me. And I wanted to change it just exactly as others change their lives in or out of the arts.
Mm-hmm. Weren't you in a car crash also?
Yes, I was in a car crash. It's kind of a UFO event. I mean, I had a fast car, and I was driving through Texas at a very high rate of speed in rural Texas, and I pulled out to pass a truck, and during the night, a kind of black frost had settled on the road. It was just a light, invisible coating of ice, and so when I pulled out, the car just went backwards, and I cracked it up, and it was such a spectacular crash. It was at 140 miles an hour or something, and it happened in apparent slow motion. The car began shedding its parts, the windshield and fenders and things like that, that just seemed that one was watching one's life come to an end. It just seemed inevitable. It didn't seem possible to go through that kind of metallic explosion and still be standing there. So when it was over, it was kind of like having died and come to life again. And it would have been remarkable to anybody. I don't think I made more of it than it was, but I just really stopped and I thought, gosh, what a miracle. I'm now going to have another life, one I really kind of don't deserve. So it was a kind of starting over point in some way that I would find hard to articulate exactly. It's just that it was a real point to stop and think.
Do you know what you did differently the second time around?
Well, I'm still in the second time around.
Right, yes, right.
So I really don't know. I mean, I suppose I live with the same, as much confusion as anyone, trying to live better and to be a better parent and a better husband, a better writer, to be more compassionate, to not be beguiled by material things, and yet to have all those same weaknesses and to want a new car and to eat better and to be selfish and not be interfered with. And so it's just the usual sort of skein of complications that one tries to tease one's way through with positive results. And it's just kind of like hacking your way through the jungle, really.
You know, I'm just curious, you used the word slow motion when you were describing what the crash felt like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a movie kind of word. So as a filmmaker, I'm wondering if it really seemed like slow motion when it was happening.
Yes, it did seem like slow motion in that you're so tremendously adrenalized with the idea that you are maybe at the end of your life, that you accumulate impressions at such a high rate of speed, it's literally like overcranking a camera, which is what produces slow motion photography. So the whole wreck, maybe it took 3 seconds, but if there were 6,000 impressions in it that you could recall,
mm-hmm.
like the hood lifting off and going over the top of the car, or a fender just sort of being peeled away by a fence post that was going 140. You get so many impressions that you really do, because to review it or to think back through it, it's really as though time were being suspended while you go through this process.
Wow. Tom Egwene is my guest. He has a new novel called Keep the Change. Your new novel has a father-son theme to it. The father dies and the son inherits the ranch and needs to decide if he wants to try to save it or not. I guess what I'm getting to is I think you were supposed to inherit your father's business, the auto supply business, and didn't really want it.
Well, it's not only that. Interesting. I've been talking, because the book's just coming out, I've been talking to interviewers and book critics and things like that, some of whom have been men, and this subject comes up. And I've just categorically stated that all sons are sort of spending a lot of the time of their lives trying to figure out what it is their father's required of them. Maybe all daughters feel that way about their mothers. I mean, do you wonder what your mother's wishing you're doing at this moment, or what she thinks of your career or your...
Oh, of course I wonder about that.
Yeah, you know, and I think that it's just one of those things that's just so there that people have kind of forgotten to define it. But most men go through their lives saying, gee, what is it that my father wanted me to do? My father was a kind of non-communicator, and I've sort of been guessing all my life. But I used to think I thought that was my private issue. But it turns out every man I've asked, I've been asking a lot of them this year, they say, yep, I sure wish I knew.
But of course, there's something even more tangible when there's a business to either be inherited or sold.
Well, I never considered going into that business. I wanted to be a writer when I was 10 years old, and my father's business came to my brother and I when I was in my 40s. I'd been out of the nest for 25 years and had been self-sufficient all that time. So it was really never a daily living factor in my life. And I never thought for a minute when I was a young kid that I was going to go into my father's business.
Mm-hmm. Well, you live in Montana now on a ranch. And
right.
I'm wondering if it's good for you to have a balance of physical things to do, like your ranch work. You own cattle and you're a cutter horse champion. Anyways, to balance physical work and writing, you know, because a lot of writers don't get to do that. They just sit all day, all season, season.
You know, I don't know how they do that, actually. I couldn't do that. I guess I lack sufficient intellectual power to just do that round the clock. I just would lose my mind. I don't require that it would be ranching, but it would have to be something else. Interestingly enough, it could be business, or it could, but it would have to be something from which the writing could come, some access to information that was not purely literary. I think that would be all right for a few years. When I was in graduate school, I was quite happy to be a completely bookish person, and I loved spending day after day in the library. But after a while, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time now. I'm going to be 50 on my next birthday, and I've been a working writer all my adult life. What would you write about? I just think it's important to have some other thing that you do. I think it'd be great to be a doctor. It'd be great to be a cab driver or a bus driver or an airline pilot or some kind of interface with the physical operating world that's out there that... I'm talking about fiction writers, not poets or essayists or literary critics. We fiction writers need to be involved. That's why people like John Cheever joined the volunteer fire department, and other writers become fanatical golfers or anything. They just need to be in the world that's not simply the literary world.
I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier. You said that there were actually only a few Westerns that you really liked a lot. Yet you've written several Westerns yourself, and I wonder why you chose that form for some of your movies.
Hollywood kind of operates by stereotypes, and frankly, in some cases, Westerns are what were offered to me.
I see.
But also, I'm interested in the history of where I live. I've now lived in Montana more than any place I ever lived, including where I grew up. And I'm interested in the history of the place and the romance of the place, and... Westerns are also the closest thing that we have to a formalized theater in a way. It's like our no theater. You don't have to sort of reinvent the form every time out. I mean, somebody once said that the classicism isn't everything, but it is the one thing which puts people to work faster than any other. And I think when you decide to write a Western, there's a certain amount of donnés, you know, that allow you to say, well, this is it. I mean, if it's a Western, it's going to be in the West, and it's going to have cowboys and maybe Indians and good guys and bad guys. And I'm saying it is with as much banality as I can, but at least there's a kind of structure there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to play against that structure. They now, you know, are so completely kind of defunct that it doesn't seem to apply. When I first was writing Westerns, there were all these firms in Hollywood that supplied horses and costumes and stunt riders and all. And they had been there since, you know, the teens of the century, and it worked all through the television Western era and so on. They no longer exist now. They'd been there for 60 or 70 years, and they've all vanished. So at least in terms of popular culture, the market share that the Western myth once held is really no longer there.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks for doing it.
I'm a listener.
Oh, great.
All right, Terry.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.